In just over 70 days, we'll have Election Day here in the United States, and we have gathered once again before a live audience in Cedar Rapids. I'm Ben Kiefer of Iowa Public Radio News, and this is a special edition of River to River. It's another edition of Pints and Politics.
And I'm Jennifer Hemmingson with the Gazette. We are very excited to partner with Iowa Public Radio for our August round of Pints and Politics. A couple of other important groups to thank: our series sponsor, ITC Midwest. Our community partner, Linn County Auditor's Office Voter Outreach Program. Our media partner, Imon Communications. And special thanks to CSPS and Legion Arts for hosting us tonight. I want to first introduce our esteemed panel, James Lynch, Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman.
Okay, let's get started with our panelists. Jennifer, good to see you again. Good to see all the panelists. They don't look any worse for wear, though they've been at political conventions not too long ago, right?
Right. I think James has got his arm in a thing, but I think that's unrelated.
It is unrelated, yes.
So tell us a little bit. The conventions have been a while ago now. Are you seeing the campaigns progress the way that you expected, seeing what you saw at the conventions? James and Linda, you are at the Democratic Convention. You want to start while Todd has another drink?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the convention is over. The convention is sort of a benchmark on the campaign trail it's sort of theater. It's a circus. It's theater. It's one of those things you sort of have to do on the way, as part of the campaign. In many ways, it doesn't serve a purpose other than giving people a chance to sort of vent and demonstrate their passion, which we saw a lot of in Philadelphia. People, passionate for Hillary Clinton, people passionate for Bernie Sanders, people passionate about, not really sure, some of them, what they were passionate about, but they were demonstrating it. And now they've recalibrated, they've set their sights on November 8th, and we're off to the races.
Yeah, I think the Democratic Convention did what it had to do for Hillary Clinton, which was basically reintroduce her in a different way that maybe we hadn't heard since she was First Lady. I still find it quite interesting that I actually met Jill Stein, the Green Party presidential nominee, at the Democratic Convention. She was very interested in the Bernie supporters who marched out and came back and marched out and came back. It was an emotional roller coaster, I think, for many of the delegates there. I think we saw that happening before our eyes within the morning breakfast that the Iowa delegation had. We had people yelling. We had people
crying,
sobbing out loud. We had cameras outside ready to capture it all and distribute it to the nation, which always happens when you're talking about Iowa. But it was a very interesting scene. And as far as the campaign progressing, I don't know how you progress from what it was, because it was basically an introduction of someone that most of us have known for 20 or 30 years.
Linda and James, if I can jump in here, what did the really hardcore Bernie or bust supporters hope to achieve? You said they were crying. What was shattered there at the convention? What hopes?
I think any time that you tie your wagon to a certain candidate, there's a potential that that candidate is not going to advance and you're going to have to untie your wagon. And sometimes that can be a very painful process. And it definitely was very emotional and very painful in Philadelphia. Some people, I was making fun before. People actually did walk out, come back, but not everyone. Some people walked out that Tuesday night once the roll call vote was done and they didn't come back. And instead, they went to a local park, which is where I met Jill Stein, and they were kind of with other Bernie Sanders supporters trying to regroup and figure out where they go from here. Are there certain issues that they want to highlight? Or, is there other things that they can do? Do they go with the Green Party? Do they go with the Libertarian Party? They don't really know what their future is going to be. So for those that kept coming back to the convention, I really don't know what they expected to gain from that. Mm-hmm. I don't. Mm-hmm. And I think toward the end of the convention, there were a lot of people, media, Clinton delegates, other observers, who were kind of upset with the Bernie Sanders people for their behavior.
I think you always see this in campaigns where there are many degrees of support, and, you know, from sort of lukewarm to passionate. And we saw that all in Philadelphia. We saw the people who understand that not everybody wins, that, you know, in the end somebody wins, somebody loses, but yet they're committed to the party. So, you know, they understand it, they can take it. There are people who were very committed to a candidate who didn't win. And so, yeah, it was harder for them. I went to a meeting of the Bernie Delegate Network, which they were the bitter enders. They were the people who were not going to give up. They were there for Bernie Sanders and nothing else. And it was just, I mean, it was sort of depressing to listen to them, because it was like, folks, it's not going to turn out like you have been hoping. I mean, it's over. But, you know, so you see the whole range of emotions and passion for the candidates.
Yeah, and, you know, I left the Iowa delegation breakfast and went over to the Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the Florida delegation breakfast, because I was kind of shocked that Debbie Wasserman Schultz would think that this was okay. You know, after the information that had come out, and it was damaging and it was horrible, for her to show up at that convention and think that she could weather this storm, I don't know what she was smoking before she came to that breakfast meeting.
She had been to the Colorado delegation, I think.
And in short, Linda, the damning information that came out was that the DNC was helping Hillary quite a bit.
Yeah, it was colluding.
Shocking.
Yeah.
So, Todd, party unity was also a struggle for the Republicans. You want to talk a little bit about how that all unfolded and what you're seeing now?
Well, I was in Cleveland, and I got back. I got back. And, I mean, I'll answer the party unity question, but I got back, and I must have written such glowing stuff about Donald Trump that they gave me a one-on-one interview the week after I got back with Donald Trump, which surprised me a little.
So,
and, I mean, I talked with him, and Aaron Jordan, another reporter, was there, and I, you know, shook his hand as polite people do, and it was like that day, the next day, he started criticizing the Gold Star family, and then we went on this two-week odyssey. Now, I don't know if my handshake had anything to do with that. Maybe I'm a huge jinx, but that was what happened. I mean, and because out of the convention, he had a bounce. He had a few points bounce. There were actually polls that showed him ahead. And, you know, the convention, there was a lot of talk at the convention about all the speakers that the Iowa delegation heard. These were folks, Scott Walker, Rick Santorum, the senator from Arkansas, other folks, who basically the whole theme of their talk is that, look, we understand that Donald Trump is not your first choice, but if Hillary Clinton wins, we're going to lose the Supreme Court, we're going to lose our constitutional republic, in the words of Rick Santorum, who gave a very odd speech because he promoted ethanol for the first half of it, and then talked about how we're going to lose our constitutional republic, and that if you want the perfect candidate, you have to wait for the second coming. And in the meantime, please use ethanol. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the doom and gloom, and it was. There were just a lot of speakers. Newt Gingrich told the Iowa delegation that we're going to wake up some morning and there's going to be a city gone because we're unsafe, because, the Democrats have made us unsafe. So that was the unifying element of that convention was, if Hillary Clinton wins, things are going to get really, really bad. So as bad as Donald Trump might seem to you, you've got to vote for him. Now, and then a lot was said afterwards, rightly, that this is not the sort of uplifting, optimistic message that usually carries a general election electorate. And that's been a problem. I mean, that's when bad things happen, when Trump says things that don't go over well, he doesn't have anything to fall back on. He doesn't have that optimistic plan. He doesn't have that sort of message where he's telling the country what exactly he's going to do to make things better. So it's not surprising that things have sort of eroded for him as the last couple of weeks have gone on.
Since that convention, during that convention, Paul Manafort, the campaign manager there, since that time, in the last few days, Paul has been put out to pasture, wherever that may be. But he's been replaced by Kellyanne Conway. Also, Steve Bannon of Breitbart News, the new campaign CEO. What happened there? And this is a question for all of you. What happened there? And in the few days since that has happened, are we seeing, well, the media loves the word pivot or reset. Has anything in that sense happened?
I mean, lots of people watch, you know, the 538.com forecast.
Yes.
And there was a point a couple of days after the Republican convention where it was 50-50. Within a week after that, it was 88-12 for Clinton. I mean, bad things happen. And when really bad things happen in a campaign, you know, you can't change the candidate. I mean, you're stuck with the candidate. So you have to change the staff. You have to change the strategy. You have to bring in new people to, at the very least, send the signal that you realize that something bad is happening and that things have to change.
It's sort of like a baseball team that's losing. You can't fire all the players, so you fire the manager and bring in a new manager and say, hey, we're going to do great from here on out. And I think in some way that's what Trump did. And we'll see how long this sort of new Trump, you know, lasts. It's not an insult a minute anymore, but, you know, can he stick to that? I doubt it.
Let me just jump in here. Pints and Politics, a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, River to River today, presented with the help of the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio, partnering up co-host Jennifer Hemmingson and our guests, James Lynch, Todd Dorman, and Linda Waddington of the Gazette, just over 70 days from the election. And we have a couple hundred people here at CSPS in Cedar Rapids. And we're collecting some questions from the audience here of our, I have to assume, audience of political junkies, whether they like to be described that way or not.
Definitely informed voters. So we've got some good questions here. And one of the themes of the campaign coverage to date has been, you know, a lot of criticism and also just a lot more attention to how media cover presidential elections and whether or not the way we cover presidential elections is actually useful in informing voters and in informing the democracy. So there's a question about that, about, you know, how we are going to cover this over the next 70 days, and is it going to change? And how is that going to influence? And then a specific one about, you know, why is Donald Trump getting away with not releasing his tax returns? Is that important? And is that something that the media has a role in sort of hammering home a little bit more?
Don't you imagine if Donald Trump released his tax returns, there'd be a note from his accountant saying, this will be the best fiscal president in American history.
Yeah. Look, his urologist.
I guess, you know, it's become sort of a tradition for candidates to release their tax returns for candidates for president, candidates for governor. It's not something that's required. I guess in a way I find it amusing because, quite frankly, I'm not sure I understand my tax returns, and I'm sure I wouldn't understand Hillary Clinton's or Donald Trump's, so I'm not sure what's gained by that. I think there's probably good reason that Donald Trump has good reasons for not releasing his tax returns. And it might show that he doesn't pay any taxes, which in and of itself, you know, if he's not breaking the law, then what's the problem? Maybe the law needs to be changed. Maybe tax law needs to be changed. I'd agree with that. But, you know, if he takes all the deductions and uses all the credits that are available, then isn't that a form of patriotism?
We do have this other issue, though, where he is now attacking the Clintons for the Clinton Foundation.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, he's wanting these donations to the Clinton Foundation to be rolled back. He's wanting the foundation to be closed down, and that's a matter of charitable giving. His taxes would show us if he has also been participating in charitable giving and to what level.
Well, when he was in Louisiana this week, was it? Yeah, this week. He supposedly said he was going to donate some money, and there's a question about whether he actually donated it. The charity says they haven't received it yet. Now, you know, the check's in the mail, I suppose.
Well, you know, we had the big event in Iowa. He was going to skip the debate, and he was going to have this big veterans event, and it was going to benefit the veterans groups. And you know, I'm y'all know this, I'm a little passionate about that, given that my brother served in Vietnam, my father served in World War II. I have a nephew that's done several tours in Afghanistan and Iraq. And when you say that you're going to support our veterans and you don't, it kind of ticks me off since I'm on the radio.
He doesn't want to release his tax returns because there's something really damaging in them. So I kind of think we deserve to know what that is before we vote. I mean, that's just, it's kind of old-fashioned. And I mean, you know, Nixon kind of started this because he wanted to prove he wasn't a crook. So if you can't pass the I'm not a crook tax disclosure test, I mean, that's pretty damning.
What about the lingering issue for Hillary Clinton, though, the email, the private server in her house, and now the latest Clinton Foundation controversy? Is there anything there that you see has a whiff of continuing on and really damaging the Clinton campaign?
I think we should have another congressional investigation. I am in favor of spending another $2-3 million of our tax dollars to investigate the Clintons one more time for their email server, for possible mob activity, for all the people they supposedly murdered. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Let's be honest. If Donald Trump was held to the same standard that the Clintons have been held to, you know, he would not be the Republican nominee right now.
So let's get back to, I noticed none of you answered the media part of that question. So what's our responsibility? What are reporters and editor and columnist's responsibility to lay all this bare to people? I mean, if no one has to date been able to make Donald Trump release his tax returns, is it the media's role? Is it a congressional investigation? Like, how do we get that done if that's important Democratic work that needs to be done?
You know, I want to start just because I've never been a state house reporter, and both of these two have, and they should be credited for the work that they've already done. But I think when reporters are traveling with a campaign and they are embedded with that campaign, and we've seen this with Hillary Clinton, and this is one place where I'm going to be very critical of Hillary Clinton, is that she has not done an actual press conference since December of last year. And that's a big problem. She has handpicked the media outlets she wants to go to. She's handpicked the time that she'll allot to them. We've seen the same thing with Joni Ernst. I was critical of her. I would be a hypocrite if I wasn't critical of Hillary Clinton for doing the same thing. But there is a big problem in America that we now have media outlets that embed journalists with political campaigns, that we assign this one journalist to be a part of that. Because it's very difficult day in and day out to travel with a campaign, to cover that campaign, to know all these little things of like what ringtone the governor has when he calls his candidate, and still give a very unbiased opinion. The other piece of that is all of you on Facebook who want the most tantalizing headlines possible when you look at candidates and when you look at political news. You know, people see that. People understand that. Journalists are responding to that responsibility for clicks. And that's translating into the most incredible headlines possible instead of perhaps real news that are going to affect your economic condition right here in Iowa.
I will say, I agree with what you said. I will say this, though. I think, you know, I read a lot of election coverage, and I think The Washington Post has done an outstanding job covering Donald Trump, even though they've been banned from his events. I mean, they can go in as a member of the public and cover him. I think that, you know, obviously they're, you know, not getting trapped in that construct, but they're, you know, they're doing an outstanding job. And I think a lot of it is maybe because the Trump campaign banned them, which, you know, the Trump campaign has gained nothing from that. But, I think part of the problem with as you described, the one person being assigned, is that your whole ability to cover a campaign depends on access. Mm-hmm. And that's where you get into trouble, because it's like, do you pull back from a story because you're afraid of losing that access? I mean, the next day, you're not going to get the nugget that you need to file your reports for that day. So, I mean, that's the pressure. That's how they get you, which is unfortunate.
Many voters would wish that we were more focused on issues. This is definitely a character-centered campaign thus far. What position does that put you in as journalists here, as columnists, when I guess we should be talking about character to some degree, but really the issues that are most important to this country are being overshadowed, aren't they, by the latest comments?
Yeah, I would agree that... And what happens if you ask an issue question, you can be deluged with statistics and numbers and how much we're going to spend on this and what we've accomplished and how far we've come, and detail that, you know, will, you know, your eyes glaze over listening to it, and certainly readers would have the same reaction as they read about all these incredible statistics and how my plan is going to save the world. So I think sometimes we do focus more on character issues. And in this election, I think there's a lot of character issues to be explored with both of these candidates. I mean, they're people that voters don't trust. They don't really like them. There are numerous examples from their past and present that I think raise issues. The whole email server issue that we talked about, I mean, that's a self-inflicted wound for the Clinton campaign, really. They probably could have cleared it up by coming clean months ago, a year ago or so. Trump, it's like every day there's something. This year it feels like it's hard to get to the issues because there's so much clutter in front of all those issues that it makes it hard to reach, you know, actually delve into it.
James Lynch, Todd Dorman, and Linda Waddington of the Gazette are panelists on this edition of Pints in Politics. Jennifer Hemmingson co-hosting with me. We have to take a break, I think, judging by the small amount of beer or lack of beer in people's pint glasses. We'll take a short break. We'll come back with more thoughts from our guests. We want to ask them about the down-ticket effect of the top candidates, Hillary Clinton and most notably Donald Trump, the impact on Iowa's congressional races. Jennifer, I'm sure you have a lot of other questions here. This is a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio, recorded before a live audience at CSPS in Cedar Rapids in partnership with the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. Is so glad to have that partner. We'll be back in just a moment. Special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. River to River today presented in conjunction, Iowa Public Radio in conjunction with the Gazette. Jennifer Hemmingson with me, my co-host here at CSPS in Cedar Rapids, and we're doing another edition of Pints and Politics. We have James Lynch and Gazette columnists Todd Dorman and Linda Waddington. Welcome back, everybody. On this edition of River to River, this special Pints in Politics, Jennifer Hemmingson with me here on a stage at CSPS in Cedar Rapids, along with Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and James Lynch of the Gazette, as we are just over 70 days away from our general election. Let's take we had a little applause poll last time. I've thought of another one for this one, and it's really good, Jennifer, that you spoke about the role of the media in this election. I would like to poll the audience of about, I don't know, a couple hundred people here in Cedar Rapids, to grade the media, the mainstream, so-called mainstream media, in covering this election campaign, including the primary. So I'll go through the grades, A through F. You are allowed to applaud, please, only for one grade. And let's see how it turns out. Clap if you would give the mainstream media an A. Clap now if you would give the mainstream media a B. Clap if you would give the mainstream media a C. Okay, what if the mainstream media returns home with a D on its report card? Okay, and being taken out to the woodshed probably for an F? Okay, what are we to make of that, Jennifer?
Well, we definitely get to do it again next election. We passed.
Well, according to one gentleman, not. But we were sleeping in class, according to one gentleman. Okay, so actually a follow-up question from the audience here concerning the media. Have you seen a change in the media coverage during this election so far? I mean, Donald Trump was an unknown factor. He was unexpected. And I guess a lot of this media coverage revolves around how Donald Trump has been covered.
Yes, definitely. And I think Donald Trump was sort of a novelty to begin with. Nobody thought he was going to run. They thought he was just toying with us. And then when he did run, nobody really took him seriously that he would win. And then when he started winning, it was like, well, but sooner or later, you know, this will fall apart or he'll get, lose interest in it, and then he's the nominee. And I think we've seen a real change in the way media is covering him compared to the way they covered him back in, you know, February or March or April. A lot of media are being much, depending on your point of view, harsher or more critical of him. I mean, when you see CNN sort of doing fact checkers as he's speaking, you know, that sort of thing, which... You know, it's really sort of interesting, and I wish they would do that for more candidates. But, yeah, we've seen a real change in the way he's being covered, although I think, you know, there's some question, is it too late to change the coverage?
But does it really matter to Donald Trump, some Donald Trump supporters, because the mainstream media is part of the problem here, right? And so when the mainstream media fact checks and says what he says is wrong, what impact?
You know, Donald Trump has sent out surveys. Two surveys so far to his supporters asking them to rate the media. Who do you trust? Where do you get your news from? That type of thing. So it's very difficult to be the media and to give a factual representation of what's happening on a stage and what claims are true and false when nobody really cares what's true or false.
You really believe that, Linda? You really believe that? That's pretty dark and cynical, Linda.
I'm pretty dark and cynical tonight. I really am.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked a lot about this before. I think that sort of the fragmentation of the media, that sometimes we blame the media, but I think part of the blame is on us, all of us, in that we choose the media that agrees with us or reinforces our point of view. And so if I don't like the mainstream media or the lamestream media, you know, and they say Donald Trump is lying or, you know, he's mistaken, no, it doesn't matter to me. If I like Hillary Clinton and, you know, there's media out there telling me that, you know, she really did send classified materials in her email, I don't need to believe them because there's somebody out there who will tell me something else.
Yeah, and I'm not sure exactly when, like, instruments like PolitiFact launched. I don't know if they launched in 2008 or before that. But they used to be taken seriously. I mean, if you got a designation of pants on fire from PolitiFact, it was a horrible thing. Nobody really cares in this election what PolitiFact has to say to you. And matter of fact, they will drag PolitiFact through the mud to show other people that they shouldn't care either.
You hear it talked about as post-factual politics, which is... I was hoping I'd never see post-factual politics, but I guess I've lived to see it. As James said, everybody can find an expert who says that what the other experts say is wrong. I mean, mm-hmm. Climate change is a good example. You can find people who will say the scientific consensus is wrong, it's a hoax. But, you know, it's still the job of reporters to try to do the best they can to portray what's being said and also to explain context as to why maybe this isn't true or why this is being said or how this fits into the context of a campaign. And I think a lot of that's being done. If, you know, But if you're on Facebook as I am, I mean, nobody's sharing New York Times, Washington Post, L.A. Times, Chicago Tribune, you know, you name it, any respectable media organization. They're sharing, you know, Occupy.com or whatever, you know, just all of these various media outlets that have these sensational stories about, you know, Donald Trump has grown a tail. Hillary Clinton is you know, having secret negotiations with ISIS. I mean, there's this stuff all over Facebook. And you look at the website, and it's like, who is that?
Yeah, I think a very good Iowa real-time example of this is that we had this LGBT rule summit at Drake University in Iowa that's hosted by the USDA. But all the headlines I saw on my Facebook feed were Rush Limbaugh saying that lesbian farmers were invading red states. So, but seriously, I mean, that's what you're putting on your Facebook feeds at the same time that you want to denigrate the lamestream or the mainstream or the people like us. That's a problem.
Well, and you almost wonder if it's an accident that we've got two candidates where we have a lot of people who are ambivalent about both of them in this kind of climate where anything goes, where facts are irrelevant or facts can be picked to suit your purpose, which kind of leads us into our next theme, which is, you know, how are these presidential candidates going to work with the down ticket races? How are they going to affect the down ticket races? So people who are, you know, straight party ideological voters, what the heck are they going to do this time around?
It's going to be interesting to watch the people who typically vote a straight ticket. There's a sort of a theory that there are a lot of Republicans who won't vote for Donald Trump, but, you know, may skip voting for president altogether, but will vote for Republicans down ticket. There may be some, you know, Sanders supporters. There may be some other Democrats who don't like Hillary Clinton who will skip voting for her. I find it hard to believe, you know, that they're going to do that. It's going to have a down ballot effect, and I think you can see that in the Senate race with Chuck Grassley and Patty Judge. That, I mean, it's much closer than Grassley's other reelection campaigns have been, and I don't think that Patty Judge is that much better than Roxanne Conlon was, or you know, but I think it is sort of the Trump effect. Where it's probably going to be more of a factor is some of those people who don't enjoy winning by 30 percentage points every time. The people who are counting for, you know, they're hoping to win by 1 or 2 percentage points, and how much is Trump going to affect them? I think that's the bigger question.
You mentioned the Patty Judge campaign. A question from our audience here at CSPS in Cedar Rapids. When is Patty Judge, asks this audience member, when is Patty Judge going to actually start running for the Senate race? Her campaign seems very quiet. I interviewed Patty Judge today about a lot of things, and correct me if I'm wrong, but she jumped into this race because of the Supreme Court controversy, which has all but faded almost completely from our news, hasn't it?
I would agree, yeah. I mean, it was a very big issue several months ago, and now it's sort of a big issue with a portion of voters, but it's not the issue that people are talking about every day and every day. I think she's going to have to sort of recalibrate her campaign and find something else to talk about that will connect voters with voters and make them want to vote for her rather than voting again for Chuck Grassley.
Well, and it seems like she's been doing a good job sort of campaigning to among groups of Democrats. I'm sort of wondering when she's going to make the jump to sort of look at those sort of moderates and independents and the folks in the middle who have voted for Chuck Grassley in the past in large numbers. I mean, when is she going to sort of do that more broader sort of more public campaign to sort of sway those voters? I think she's got the Democratic activists in her corner. It's just a matter of wondering whether she can expand that coalition and grab some of those votes that Grassley traditionally gets. I mean, it's difficult because Chuck Grassley, I mean, he's got $6 million?
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, she's gonna run these ads and they get some attention, and then Chuck's gonna run 30 ads, and that's gonna get a lot of attention. He'll be on the lawnmower maybe, and maybe he'll have another old car, but I mean Patty's not an insurgent, but when I say insurgent campaign, I mean a campaign that's going to upend a popular incumbent. There needs to be sort of an exciting moment or a big turnaround moment, and I don't know when that's going to come for Patty Judge. I'm skeptical that she's going to be able to sort of have that campaign that turns a 10-point lead for Grassley into suddenly a 1 or 2-point lead. I don't know how that happens.
Yeah, I don't think Patty Judge wins this campaign. I think Chuck Grassley might lose this campaign.
Joining us on this edition of Pints and Politics, a special edition of River to River, Jennifer Hemmingson, my co-host, also from the Gazette. We have James Lynch, Todd Dorman, and Linda Waddington.
Going back to this where's Patty question, are you seeing that a lot, we talked about this with the presidential races, but are you seeing that a lot of our congressional campaigns also are doing closed-door events, doing smaller events, not getting out there to the public, and is that a wise move?
Well, wise, if you're talking about for, you know, the good of the democracy, no, it's not good if they're doing sort of the closed-door events and I mean, because, you know, part of this running for office should be appearing before large, diverse groups of people, not a select audience of people who have already made up their mind. But more and more of that seems to be sort of the tactic of campaigns is talk to your base, talk to your base, talk to your base, and you know, run as many ads as you can and hope that you sway 1 or 2% to your direction. You know, we see it in a number of ways. You know, there's more debate about the number of debates candidates will have than there are actual debates between candidates. Sooner or later they run out of time and say, well, you know, I guess we won't have any debates because we've run out of time talking about debates.
Well, voters are picking their media and candidates are picking their audiences, and we're just not all going to get together, I guess.
No.
You know, I think this is a larger issue, though. I think we used to have people who ran for public office because they wanted to be public servants.
Yeah, and actually convince people who didn't agree with them to agree with what they say. I mean, there's no convincing anymore. There's basically bludgeoning your opponent and hoping that your side turns out.
Yeah. Well, what happens to are we up to 40% no party voters in Iowa? Isn't that the largest block? What happens to them?
Yeah.
What happens to them if they can't come to these sort of exclusive events and hear more about candidates?
You know, we've seen this happen in Europe. We've seen this story before, that we had these third parties that came out and have just completely changed the landscape of Europe, completely changed what everybody thought about politics, And I'm wondering if this election is the same thing for America. Is this the point where the two-party dominant system is no longer enough representative of who we are, that we need a third or a fourth or a fifth? And I don't know. I'm not convinced yet that this is it, but I think we're on the cusp of what this might be.
Yeah, I would say that this is not the election where that will happen. And I think part of what will make that happen is having a very dynamic third or fourth party candidate. And I don't really see that this year. Gary Johnson, is somebody who was a governor, was reelected. He's got good credentials in that way. But I'm not sure he's Bernie Sanders as a third party candidate might have been more successful than as a Democrat.
Or one of the Republicans. I mean, one of the...
Well,
yeah, right.
Could have had 17
one of the gang,
parties.
The gang of 17. I mean, it's... What may happen, though, is that, whoever wins this presidential election is going to be, probably vastly unpopular. They may inherit a Congress that isn't their party. We're going to have 4 years of gridlock and fighting. That can only help third parties. The longer things don't get solved, the longer, this sort of goes on. I mean, the better the chances that someone's going to be able to make an argument that says, let's not do this anymore. Let's do something. There's a third way.
Let's hear your thoughts on the congressional races here in Iowa. There are five of six of the races that are up up for re-election. One senatorial race, we've just talked about that with Patty Judge against Senator Grassley. Then we've got the other congressional races. Of the Republicans there, because the Democrats do think that it is within the realm of possibility to grab the House, not only the Senate, but also the House. Of our congressional delegation in the House, who is most vulnerable, David Young, Rod Blum, or Steve King?
Well, I think probably Rod Blum here in the 1st District, just because of the voter registration numbers. It's a district that Democrats should carry. He carried it 2 years ago, and I'm not sure that the electorate is a lot different. It's a presidential election. Typically, more Democrats turn out in a presidential election than in an off-year election. So there's a lot of hope among Democrats that, you know, they can take back that seat. There was a poll out this week commissioned by the Blum campaign that showed him up by 7 points. It's still early. And that's what I was talking about is in those, you know, the Trump effect in those down ballot races where somebody's hoping to win by a percentage point or two, you know, if Trump is a drag, a percentage point or two disappears. David Young, I think, has probably got a tough race ahead of him. It's a district that could go either way. Steve King, now he's not in any trouble. I mean, he's you know, his district elected him, and they'll keep electing him for a long time.
Well, I mean, Iowans are sort of famous ticket splitters as far as, you know, in 96, I think it was Clinton won Iowa, Bill Clinton, and Tom Harkin narrowly won re-election. At the same time, the Democrats lost the state Senate. Two years before that in 94, Republicans, I think, thought they had a good chance in a wave election of taking the Senate, and the state Senate remained Democratic. So, I mean, there's a lot of times Iowans aren't swayed so much by the top of the ticket. So I don't know how much Trump, if he continues to have problems, I don't know how much that bleeds down to those lower ballot races. I mean, I agree with James that Rod Blum and David Young have tough races because those are difficult districts for Republicans in a lot of instances. But yeah, I mean, Steve King, he's the king of that House district, and no matter what the folks who read what he says across the nation think, he's probably going to continue to have a seat in Congress.
Okay, we're coming to the end of our time here. It's been a wonderful time before this audience at CSPS in Cedar Rapids with Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, and James Lynch. Jennifer, again, thanks to the Gazette for inviting Iowa Public Radio back to be part of Pints and Politics. One quick question for our panelists, if I can, in the short time we have remaining. If you were Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, what would be keeping you up late at night, keeping you up, keeping you from sleep? Any thoughts on that?
If I was Donald Trump, what would keep me awake at night would be thinking about, what the heck am I going to do if I win? How do I get out of this?
There are conspiracy theories that he actually doesn't want to win, and that's why he's behaved as he has, right?
It seems to be working.
I would be awake because my unfavorables are so high that any problem I have, I know that there are going to be blocks of voters that move to the other side. And who's going to make the last mistake before the election? I mean, which way are voters going to move at the end? And I mean, that's because they're both vastly unpopular according to polls, and so the loyalty to them by those sort of voters in the middle is low. If something happens, they'll move, and that's what would keep me up.
It's not if something.
Yeah, I think drawing from personal experience, I'd have to say it's Iowa State Fair Food. except that
that's,
neither
that's
of them
the
bothered
up.
To show up at this year's Iowa State Fair.
I just want to say this is tremendous, the third time that Iowa Public Radio has partnered with the Gazette. We love being here in Cedar Rapids and sharing politics and pints. Religion and politics don't mix. We've heard that, but I guess pints and politics certainly do. Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Pints and Politics, recorded yesterday evening with Jennifer Hemmingson, James Lynch, Linda Waddington, and Todd Dorman of the Gazette before a live audience at CSPS in Cedar Rapids. Our producer today, Emily Woodbury. Sound engineer, Jim Davies. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.